little sugar with that, Bessie?
I need a little sugar in my bowl. I need a little hot dog on my roll.
Rainy days and Mondays always get me down.
Try to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no.
Yes, yes, yes. Bessie Smith begets Karen Carpenter begets Amy Winehouse. The genealogy of bad girl pop. Rainy days and Tuesdays. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 29th, and we will take a look at Amy Winehouse. Has the bad girl musician, well, has she spawned others? Also, a look at the deadly multiple attacks in Iraq over the weekend. Could they mean a change in militant tactics? Zimbabwe reports today the power-sharing talks between the embattled president and his opposition leader rival have stalled. NASA turns 50 and jetpacks. Could you strap one on and fly away? We'll explain those stories and all the day's news. A new U.S.-backed military operation has begun in the volatile Diyala province northeast of Baghdad. The operation, dubbed Omens of Prosperity, is the latest effort to control a largely rural area considered one of the toughest insurgent strongholds for al-Qaeda in Iraq. An internal audit suggests former Justice Department officials broke the law by weeding out those who were not loyal to the Bush administration politics during the hiring process. Among questions the report says were asked to potential hires, quote, what is it about George W. Bush that makes you want to serve him?
Just days before the Olympics, Amnesty International has released a scathing report on China's human rights record. It asserts that China's human rights record has gotten worse since it was awarded the big games. The report urges world leaders to keep the pressure on China to improve human rights even after the games are over. Tough economic news from the White House. First, new federal budget figures show President Bush will leave behind at least a $482 billion deficit for the next president. It's the biggest deficit ever in terms of dollars. And the White House also says economic growth this year isn't going to be as good as initially expected. It predicts gross domestic product to grow by only 1.6% this year, more than 1% lower than February's outlook.
In politics, Barack Obama meets with Pakistani Prime Minister Yusuf Gilani and later with House Democrats today. John McCain holds the town hall meeting in Sparks, Nevada, and attends fundraisers in Nevada and Colorado.
Oil gained more than a dollar yesterday. It's still just below $125 a barrel. The Dow lost more than 2%. It's at 11,131. The S&P, which also lost about 2% yesterday, starts the day trading at 1234. Jetpacks. You mentioned jetpacks. I've been waiting for my jetpack.
Really? For how long?
Oh, man, since I could read.
Where are you going?
Yeah, well, anywhere there's no traffic, I think, is where I would ride a jetpack. Where would you ride a jetpack? What technology do you think you'll get before your life is up? What are you waiting for? That's the takeaway question today.
Or are you really waiting for NASA to take a human back to the moon?
That's right.
Are you waiting for that?
NASA turns 50 today. All on The Takeaway. My Take, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Technology in your lifetime. Good morning, everybody. We begin today in Baghdad, where we're joined live from Baghdad by the BBC correspondent Jim Muir. Jim, we saw a bloody day in Baghdad yesterday. 61 people killed in the final count. There's a military offensive underway by the Iraqi military in Diyala province, and perhaps not a surprise, but a change in leadership on the U.S. military side. All three of those things begin with the province of Diyala, where there's an offensive underway. Is this symbolic, or are there tactical goals in this offensive?
Well, from what we're being told, it's a lot more than symbolic. It's a major attempt to bring this whole province of Diyala, which has remained very trouble-stricken despite the fact that the situation's improved in most of the country over the last year, to bring it completely under control as part of the overall campaign that's been going on for more than a year now called imposing the law, in other words, to bring the area under direct control of the Iraqi government, with, of course, the help of U.S. troops. So what's happening is that they've taken a whole bunch of extra troops and police up from Baghdad, and top officers as well, and they are now overseeing a big operation there. It's involving combing the regional capital, Baquba, which has seen many bombings and attacks in the last year, and also outlying areas. And they do have specific, what they call targeted individuals or whatever, suspects, wanted men that they're trying to get hold of. And the whole idea this time, and it has been, the preparations have been largely kept secret, the idea this time is to catch the insurgents or the Al-Qaeda leaders they believe are in the area, rather than making such a fanfare in advance that they have plenty of time to escape, which is what's happened in the past.
Let's look at the tactics here. In the first tentative offensives by Iraqi forces, the U.S. would typically lead, or the coalition forces would lead. There'd be heavy coalition air support, and the Iraqi troops would take up support positions or possibly in the rear. How has that changed in the years since Iraqi forces have gotten more experienced at this kind of thing?
Well, things have moved on quite a bit. It's basically largely Iraqi forces who are in the forefront of these operations nowadays, with the Americans more in a kind of logistical backup role. Of course, they do have combat troops there on the ground, and they do have air support to be brought in if necessary. But as the events down in Basra showed, for example, in the spring, that was an operation launched by the Iraqi government without the Americans even really knowing about it. Now, that's not to say this is like that at all. No, the Americans are deeply involved, but the whole idea these days is to try and get the Iraqis to be standing up, to be doing it for themselves with help where necessary, but not with the Americans completely in there doing the basic job while the Iraqis look on.
Let's shift to the carnage yesterday. You mentioned that in the sort of blunt calculus of bloodshed in Baghdad, that there were signs that Al-Qaeda or the insurgency has a limited ability to carry out civilian attacks, because these were foot suicide bombers as opposed to vehicle bombings. Is there any sense, because these were targeted at pilgrims, Shiite pilgrims, at least in the Baghdad attack, that religious violence is being inflamed now as we head into the next several months?
That's clearly the intention of the people carrying out these attacks, because these are sectarian attacks, presumably carried out by Sunnis against Shiites who are carrying out their religious rituals. So you can't get much more sectarian than that. In the past, these attacks, which have been very numerous on Shiite religious gatherings, have triggered spirals of sectarian violence, with especially the Shiite militias hitting back. Now the feeling is that there is a very limited ability by the Shiite militias to do that. They're very much on the run themselves. Since the spring, the government forces and, of course, the Americans have been moving very strongly against them. So the feeling is that that spiral of sectarian violence is still potentially there, but that the means for pursuing it have been greatly diminished, so that these attacks, which are on a lesser scale than they used to be and much less frequent than they used to be, at the moment they seem to be being largely contained.
Well, one can scarcely imagine the extent to which people of Baghdad are deadened by all of this. Finally, General Dierno takes over from Petraeus, who's off to CENTCOM. What's the practical sort of sense of that shift in Baghdad, if there is any? It's certainly not a surprise.
It's not a surprise, and it had been expected, but I think everybody does credit General Petraeus with a lot of the progress that has been made, and specifically also his partnership with Ryan Crocker, the U.S. ambassador here. They've worked really in harness together as a team in a way that hadn't really been that apparent before. So I think people will obviously miss General Petraeus, but with Ray Odierno, of course, they've got a man who knows Iraq very well, who has worked with General Petraeus. So I think the sense is that there will be a continuity there. We're not going to see any abrupt changing of tactics. I think very much in the same line with the same strategies and tactics.
Well, a man who knows Iraq very well, Jim Muir, thank you very much for being with us.
Most welcome.
Jim Muir, BBC correspondent, joining us live from Baghdad. Adora?
John, now we're going to Johannesburg, South Africa, to the BBC's correspondent, Peter Biles, who has been monitoring the power-sharing talks that have been going on between Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe and his rival opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
Good morning.
Peter, just a week ago, we saw Mugabe and Tsvangirai shaking hands, and there was this hope that perhaps there would be a turn away from the deadly clashes and the alleged systematic government-sponsored harassment of the opposition. And here we are, these talks already falling apart. What happened?
Well, it certainly was an historic handshake last Monday in Harare between Morgan Tsvangirai of the opposition Movement for Democratic Change and his longtime adversary, President Robert Mugabe. In fact, they'd not met for more than 10 years before the days when Mr. Tsvangirai took on his role as an opposition leader. Prior to that, he was leader of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions, and it was in that capacity that he had last met Mr. Mugabe in 1998. I think it was always to be expected that there would be a few hitches along the way, although the various parties involved, the two factions of the MDC, because the opposition is split, and the governing ZANU-PF party, have committed themselves to this process of dialogue, which it is envisaged should be completed within 2 weeks of last week's signing ceremony. But this morning there are headlines in the paper. For example, here, the Star newspaper in Johannesburg says, "Hiccup in the Zimbabwe crisis talks," and the Times newspaper, a tabloid, says, "The Zimbabwe talks have stalled." What we know from opposition sources is that there is apparently a deadlock, and it appears to revolve around the allocation of posts. Morgan Tsvangirai rejecting the position of third vice president, which has apparently been offered to him by ZANU-PF.
I mean, but not only did he reject it, in fact, his negotiators have called it insulting and accused the Mugabe negotiators of operating in less than good faith.
Well, understandably so, because Morgan Tsvangirai won the majority of votes in the first round of voting on the 29th of March this year. He secured 47% of the vote. Robert Mugabe only got 43%. It wasn't an absolute knockout for Mr. Tsvangirai. He would have needed more than 50% to secure victory on the first count. But that is why we went into a runoff election at the end of June, a second round of voting, which Mr. Tsvangirai then decided to boycott. And that election, which saw the re-election of Robert Mugabe, of course, has been widely regarded as a sham. And that's why we're now into negotiations on power sharing, some sort of negotiated settlement. And I don't think it's really any surprise that there are difficulties along the way. They were never going to sort out the problems of Zimbabwe in less than 2 weeks, I suspect.
Does this bode well for the power of South African President Mbeki, who has been mediating these talks? Because this notion of Morgan Tsvangirai becoming the third vice president behind two of Mugabe's loyalists doesn't sound like that would be a power-sharing arrangement.
No, and I think the real problem in these talks is the position of Mr. Mugabe himself, because the MDC have long made it clear that they do not want to form any kind of inclusive government, a unity government, a transitional government, call it what you will. They are not prepared to see Robert Mugabe remain in a senior position of authority. They certainly don't want him to see. They certainly don't want to see him remain as executive president. Perhaps a ceremonial president would be acceptable to them, but they regard Mr. Tsvangirai as the winner of these elections that have been so disputed this year, and they feel that he should settle probably for nothing less than the post of prime minister. But ultimately, of course, they would like to see him running the country.
Finally, Peter, any sense of when they will get back together, even though the headlines are talking about stalled talks? Is there something coming up next?
Well, we're not absolutely sure about this, but it seems that the delegation from ZANU-PF, the ruling party, has gone back to Harare to consult, presumably, with Mr. Mugabe and his supporters. On the other hand, Mr. Tsvangirai, the leader of the MDC, mm-hmm. has come down to South Africa to consult with his team, which has been involved in the negotiations, and it is hoped, of course, that those talks would resume within a day or two.
Peter Biles, thank you. Peter Biles coming to us from Johannesburg for the BBC.
Hopefully a timeout, not a full-scale stall.
You can only hope, but it certainly sounds like the two sides are very far apart. Good morning. It's Tuesday, and it's July 29th, and we're asking you about jetpacks today. Would you like your very own jetpack? And if you had one, where would you go? Or would you like NASA to send another man to the moon? Is that something you'd like to see? Is it worth the millions, billions of dollars it might cost? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now we're going to move on to President Bush, who yesterday met with the new Pakistani Prime Minister, Yusuf Razi Gilani, in Washington for the very first time. And here's a bit of what the Prime Minister had to say.
We are committed to fight against those extremists and terrorists who are destroying and making the world not safe.
A commitment this coming just hours after a suspected U.S. missile strike killed six alleged Taliban fighters, not in Afghanistan, but in Pakistan. They met, the president and the prime minister, at a time of increasing tensions between the allies as Taliban attacks against U.S. troops have grown bolder and more frequent. But the two countries, while relying on one another, don't always see eye to eye. Joining us for a closer look is Stephen Cohen, a senior at the Brookings Institution and author of the book, An Idea of Pakistan. He spent 30 years studying the region. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning.
Right now, what is the U.S.'s Pakistan policy?
Well, I think it's certainly shifted a great deal from what it was even a year ago. I think that the administration has decided to support this new civilian government. It has democratic legitimacy. It's still number one priority is still the war, the so what they call the war on terrorism, although that term isn't used as much as it used to be. And thirdly, and secondarily, and of a lesser interest, is concern about Pakistan's nuclear program. That remains a concern, but to address that, you have to go through Pakistan itself. So there's no interest in a direct action against the military, against the nuclear program.
Would you call the U.S. and Pakistan uncomfortable bedfellows? Pakistan needs the money, the funding that we provide, and the U.S. needs Pakistan for entry into Afghanistan as well as in helping battle al-Qaeda in the northwest provinces of Pakistan.
Well, I think it's more than money. I think it's political support. I think it's strategic and diplomatic support, and not simply for Pakistan's policy vis-a-vis Afghanistan, but Pakistan's relations with India. I think the administration has come to the conclusion that, or some American politicians now are talking about the need to not only address Pakistan's domestic instability and chaos, which is marked, but also Pakistan's external environment, which implies a relationship with India. So I think Obama said this, and I think the other politicians may agree with it. Pakistan is a state in a period of acute crisis. It's going on for 10 or 15 years now. This is not something recent. So our concern with Pakistan is about Pakistan's integrity and not simply support that Pakistanis may give to the Taliban in Afghanistan.
Well, then what do you make of this new prime minister, Yusuf Gilani? It's certainly the first time Americans have seen him up close in any sense, and he represents a new kind of very soft-spoken leader for the people of Pakistan, certainly after Musharraf.
Yeah, after Musharraf, anybody would be soft-spoken. He's a quiet man, although in Urdu, in Punjabi, he's much more articulate than he is in English. But he was a party functionary. He was close to Benazir Bhutto. He served 5 years in prison. He's one of those dedicated Pakistan People's Party cadres who've spent their lives to supporting Benazir and the idea of a liberal, secular party in Pakistan. I think he represents, from an American perspective, the best government we're ever going to get in Pakistan. Not himself personally, but the people around him and the party structure. It is the only coherent political party in Pakistan other than the army. So I think we're not going to get any better than he gets. And what concerns me is that he and the PPP have stumbled during this first couple of months. Whether they can manage to turn Pakistan around is still doubtful, but I think that we have no choice but, in a sense, to support them and give them 6 months or a year before any clear results come out. I think we can afford to wait. I don't think Taliban is a problem, but I don't think Afghanistan is a problem, but I think that there's no other strategy, so we have to do that.
Does the U.S. feel that same way? I mean, last week you had not only Condoleezza Rice, but you also had the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mullen saying that Pakistan needs to do more, and they're well aware that this new government is terribly fragile.
I think they're saying that, not addressed to the government, because I don't think there's any problem there, but I think they're addressing that to the Pakistan military. I was at a dinner last night with Gilani, and he said that the first Afghan war against the Soviets was Charlie Wilson's war, which implies an American war. This war, he said, is Benazir Bhutto's war, which implies a Pakistani war. fact, I think that our major concern is with the Pakistan military. I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind that these civilians in this government want to see Islamic radicalism eradicated from Pakistan and would like to stop their support any support from Pakistan for the Taliban in Afghanistan. But the army has different views. The army has always seen Afghanistan as
a very powerful army, I might
add. And in a sense, the civilians can order the army to do something, and the army may or may not do it. And the further, the army may not be equipped to deal with counterinsurgency, which is the task at hand. They may simply not have the ability to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think our public remarks are addressed as much to the army. And that's why we agreed to the sale of or the upgrading of the F-16 aircraft for Pakistan as an incentive for the army.
Okay, Stephen Cohen, we'll have to leave it there. Many thanks to you.
Good morning. Thank you. Happy to help you. Bye.
Stephen Cohen is senior at the Brookings Institution and author of the book, An Idea of Pakistan. Now we're going to get the latest headlines from Femi Oke. Femi?
Thanks, Adora. 28 minutes past the hour, the U.S. military has launched a new operation in the insurgent stronghold Diyala province, northeast of Baghdad. A new Justice Department report says that former Justice Department aides used improper hiring practices to favor White House loyalists. 1.5 tons of American beef has arrived in South Korea. The first shipment since beef imports were banned after mad cow disease was discovered in the U.S. 5 years ago. And the RAND Research Center, which counsels the Pentagon, is urging U.S. officials to stop using the term war on terror. They prefer counter-terrorism. Now, it's been a little while since we checked in on the trial at Guantanamo Bay Naval Base, and that's the trial of Salim Hamdan. He's Osama bin Laden's former driver. Now, prosecutors on Monday showed a graphic video to a 6-member panel responsible for delivering the verdict in his trial. They saw in the video scenes of the Twin Towers collapsing, footage of charred bodies stripped to flesh in the U.S. embassy bombings in Africa, a body of a U.S. soldier being dragged through the streets in Somalia back in 2003. During watching the video, the crowd in the courtroom kept on saying, "Oh my God." It's called the Al-Qaeda plan, and it's an echo of a video known or a film known as the Nazi plan, which was used as evidence during the Nuremberg war crime trials after World War II. Now, Hamdan's attorneys objected to the video, but the judge in the case allowed it, saying that it may prejudice the court, but still he thought it was admissible evidence.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Tried to make me go to rehab, I said no.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckaberry in rehab, actually, here in the studio. Amy Winehouse has sold 10 million albums. Hard to believe. Is it just the albums, or is it a whole kind of Amy Winehouse lifestyle that determines this latest pop act, who, by the way, is in the hospital, I believe, this morning? She's had a sort of a tortured existence for the last few months. It's been a year and a half since Amy Winehouse really blew into the top of the charts. Here to talk about whether Amy Winehouse is just another in the bad girl blips of pop music and culture, or something fundamentally different, is our takeaway contributor and culture critic, and really we like to think of her as our bad girl.
Thank you.
Mary Elizabeth Williams.
The bad girl of early morning radio.
Bad girl, the baddest of the bad.
Bad girls are not blips, John. They are the cornerstone of rock and roll.
Well, I began this hour with a montage of Bessie Smith, who was talking about a little sugar in her bowl and eating a hot dog in her roll.
I don't know what you're talking about.
But I mean, Bessie Smith is a bad girl, and she recorded 160 songs, was the biggest blues singer, back in the 1920s. Then we had Karen Carpenter from the 1970s, a very different sort of act. But
little
she
different.
Met an untimely death from an eating disorder. So there's some sort of quality
messed
there.
Up
now
ladies.
Now we're Amy Winehouse.
We're Amy Winehouse, who, yes, is in the hospital today, who also has one of the best-selling albums of the entire decade. Now,
really,
it's almost 10 million units. It's one of the top selling albums of the decade. And in her wake, yes, we have this new group of young ladies, most of whom are under 25, and all of whom are saying some really interesting and new things.
Well, let's set them up and hear them, and then talk about which one is a throwback, which one is just a kind of an Amy Winehouse ripoff, and who's
rip-off.
Like in new territory. This is Kate Nash. All right.
I'm not in love. I just wanna be touched. I just want your kiss, my kiss, my kiss, my kiss. I just want your
Forget love. Just give me the nasty. That sounds pretty straightforward to me.
I think it's pretty clear cut where she's coming from. That's Kate Nash. She's 21. She had a number one album in the UK earlier this year. It's also one of the top selling albums in the world right now. And it's a different kind of sound. You know, you look at the pop scene in the last couple of years, and you think of the other girls who have been dominating it. Your Hannah Montanas and your what you've got are the High School Musicals. And then at the other extreme, you've got your pole dancers, you've got your Pussycat Dolls. And somewhere in the middle now, we're seeing these girls, these young women, who are talking and singing and writing their own music and are talking about things that young women are really experiencing and feeling. And guess what? Some girls really do just want your kiss, and that's okay.
And there is a kind of toughness and confidence to some of these characters. Here's Duffy, and this is from a YouTube video of her song Mercy.
You got me begging you.
Feeling Winehouse ripoff here.
Oh, she sounds a lot like Amy Winehouse. And just to push back a bit on your premise there, I mean, what about you had Pat Benatar in the 80s who pushed the envelope a bit? You had Madonna in the 90s, and you had Avril Lavigne in the early part of this decade. So you certainly have had women who have come out, young women who have come out and had very explicit lyrics and pushed the boundaries.
Well, what's interesting about these ladies is, first of all, that they are all writing their own material and that they're all performing and they're all playing it, which is different than a lot of these kind of prefab groups that we've been seeing for the last couple of years. And what's also great about them, I think, and what is appealing and I think is a reason that they resonate, is because they are borrowing from a whole bunch of different styles and genres. It's not just the Pinks, the tough kind of rocker chick. It's appropriating imagery that's very feminine, that's very girly, and saying, but I'm going to do my own twist on this, and I'm going to take from soul, I'm going to take from blues, and I'm also going to take from rap and hip-hop, and they're really melding music in a new way, and I think that's why it's really striking a chord.
In the YouTube era, they're pushing a lifestyle. It's not just, it seems to me, the music. I mean, you're seeing a whole performance persona in a lot of these artists, and they come to us fully formed. Here's Katy Perry. Tell us a little bit about this song. Oh, great. I hope my daughters are up this morning. Thanks a lot, Mary Elizabeth. Terrific.
You know, hey, we've all been freshmen in college. That's all I'm saying. We've all worn those shoes a little bit. And she's writing a song that's about that, that's about a female experience. This is the number one song in the country. It has been for the last 5 weeks. Her album came out just a month ago, and it's already well on its way to going gold.
Is this her first album?
This is her first album. She is a former Christian pop artist. She's the daughter of two ministers.
How's that going over?
And she's tasting cherry chapstick off of the lips of other girls.
You know what?
How's that going over with her other fans?
There's been a certain amount of backlash, surprise, from the Christian music industry, but also from the gay and lesbian community for her, flirtations with this kind of gay lifestyle. But this is something that girls are experiencing. It makes sense.
All right. Before I get a towel to sort of wipe the fear off my face about my daughter. I have two 10-year-olds listening to this morning. We're going to have you stick around. These are pop acts, we should say. These aren't fringy sort of lifestyle. These are huge pop acts.
Biggest acts in the world.
We'll talk a little more about that, and we want to get you a jetpack.
Thank you. I'm going to need that to get home.
Mary Elizabeth Wilson.
Member-supported.
A jetpack for everyone.
That's right. A jetpack for everyone. We're egalitarian on this show. But now it's time for headlines from the Bad Girl of News. Femi, okay.
Thank you very much. 21 minutes to the hour. The White House is offering a gloomy economic forecast, saying the gross domestic product will grow only 1.6% this year, while the jobless rate is expected to climb to 5.3%. John McCain is waiting for the results of a biopsy after his dermatologist removed a spot from his cheek. The candidate says that it does not seem serious. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad told NBC that he sees common ground with the West over his country's disputed nuclear program. Now, the number of homes destroyed by the so-called Telegraph Fire that's raging near California's Yosemite National Park is up to 25, and now as many as 4,000 others are threatened by the flames. Australia has unveiled new immigration laws, scrapping its policy of automatically looking up asylum seekers on arrival. And a report released Monday by the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials is about bridges. It says that at least $140 billion is needed to make major repairs or upgrades to one out of every four bridges in the country. Bridges usually in the States are built to last about 50 years, and the average bridge in this country is about 43 years old. It's the cost of materials up by at least 50% in the last 5 years that's forced construction delays and maintenance delays as well. Almost every state is facing some kind of funding shortages. Now, just 2 days before the report, a big chunk of concrete fell off a bridge in St. Paul, Minnesota. So it was a very timely time to look at this report. And of course, August the 1st, do you remember? That's the anniversary of the massive bridge collapse in Minnesota.
I was just going to say that's all they need in Minnesota is some suggestion that there are more bridges that are not very safe. And I believe that that bridge is supposed to be, the new one is supposed to go up by the end of the year.
They're trying to get it done for the convention. They're trying to, there's a Republican convention is there. They don't want to have any falling concrete for the convention. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway, and I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's the anniversary of a drama that's part science, part global politics. 50 years ago today, President Dwight Eisenhower signed the National Aeronautics and Space Act, creating NASA, combining the various U.S. efforts to get into space into a single agency. NASA put a flag on the moon for all the people of planet Earth, and it created the biggest celebrities in the world back in 1959. They were called astronauts.
These, ladies and gentlemen, are the nation's Mercury astronauts.
But it really began as a competition for political power. Eisenhower formed NASA about 6 months after the Soviet Union launched Sputnik into space. The Soviet launch shocked the nation, increased fears. Edward Teller, father of the U.S. hydrogen bomb, said it was a greater defeat for the U.S. than Pearl Harbor. But the Americans, through NASA, were determined. Eisenhower's successor, John F. Kennedy.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
That was the decade of the 60s, and Kennedy called for millions of dollars to fund a space program to get the first man on the moon by 1970. Hoping to beat the USSR, to show the U.S. was more powerful in space, it was science, military power, and propaganda, all with the same trajectory, to the moon. It began with the Mercury program.
Godspeed, John Glenn. 2-1.
Roger, the clock is operating. We're underway.
And Mercury begat Gemini. That was two astronauts in a capsule. There were spacewalks. Each mission was a drama, getting closer to the unimaginable. JFK did not live, of course, to see his mission to the moon fulfilled, but Neil Armstrong made it official in July of 1969.
I'm going to step off the landing. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. Oh, that looks beautiful from here.
But it was almost 40 years ago. In that time of NASA, there were setbacks and tragedies, the deaths of three Apollo astronauts in a fire in 1967, the explosion of the Challenger in 86, the fiery destruction of the Columbia shuttle in 2003. Today, NASA and the space program have drifted back into a proxy war of geopolitics, but with considerably less attention from the world. There are other competitors to NASA now. Private sector space nuts like billionaire Richard Branson. And China is a new global competitor. Here's George Bush in 2004 pledging to return to the moon by 2020, this time to try and beat the Chinese.
In the past 30 years, no human being has set foot on another world. America has not developed a new vehicle to advance human exploration in space in nearly a quarter century. It is time for America to take the next steps. Today, I announce a new plan to explore space and extend a human presence across our solar system.
But for a variety of reasons, most of them financial, China will almost certainly win this leg of the space race. And the space race today isn't just a show of power anymore. It is power. Control of space means control of spy satellites, GPS locators, satellite weaponry, communication, even monitoring and possible control of climate. Pipe dreams? Perhaps. But the big irony is 50 years later, the finish line in the space race is still, oddly enough, the moon. Should we go there? Call us at 877-8MyTake. Or you can email us at
www.thetakeaway.org.
She's on the moon. My co-host, Victoria Doce.
Good morning on this Tuesday, July 29th. We have some headlines for you coming from Femi Okeh. Femi.
Hello there. 12 minutes to the hour. President Bush has authorized the execution of a former army private convicted of rape and murder who's been on death row for 20 years. A new Justice Department report says that aides used improper hiring practices to favor White House loyalists. The federal deficit is the biggest it's ever been at $482 billion, and that's without additional funding for Iraq. The Iraqi military begins a U.S.-backed operation in Diyala province today to clear all al-Qaeda militants from what is considered the last major insurgent stronghold near the capital. And in Zimbabwe, power-sharing talks between President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai have broken off. And that's a quick look at your national and international headlines.
Thanks very much, Femi. And also in the news today, Google, they better watch out. Today, the daddy of all search engines. Well, it has a new competitor in the virtual search engine world. It's called Cool, actually spelled C-U-I-L, which means knowledge in Gaelic. In true Freudian fashion, this upstart is the brainchild of former members of the Google family, Anna Patterson, and her husband, Tom Costello, who is actually from Ireland, hence the name. They claim that Cool will offer broader and faster searches. And taking a dig at accusations that Google violates your privacy, Cool, they say, does not keep information about what you search and when. Joining us for his take on Cool and what this means for Google's future is our friend, Siva Vaidyanathan. Hi there.
Hey, good morning.
How are you?
Doing all right.
And you're working on a book called The Googleization of Everything, so you are well positioned to give us your thoughts on this new upstart, Cool. Why now, and why are they backed with so much venture capitalist dollars?
Well, Google in its immense growth over the past 10 years has sort of revealed a lot of concerns. Well, it's also revealed a tremendous amount of revenue, right? So anybody has a obvious desire to any major company that could do a search engine has a desire to sort of muscle in on this business. But what we have here is that Google, as good as it is, isn't perhaps as good as search could be. In addition, Google tends to keep a whole lot of our information. In other words, it tracks what we do. It keeps a dossier on
what we search for.
Did you have a nice birthday, Siva?
Think
last June 16th.
Pardon me?
Did you have a nice birthday, June 16th?
I sure did.
Yeah. See, if you Google Cool, it comes right up. It's much better than Google.
Yeah. What do they offer? It is interesting.
Your book is right there at the top too. No, sorry, Dora. I'm just.
What does it offer, seeing that it's two veterans from Google, Anna Patterson and her husband? Clearly, they're well-versed in what Google offers. What does Cool do that would make me want to switch?
Well, three basic things. One is the interface is different. Your experience of looking at results is different. They, instead of laying it out in a list from top to bottom, which gives the impression of some sort of order and priority and specificity, it offers you three columns of information where it's sort of splayed out. It actually fits better in a computer screen. That's number one, and it's going to take a while to get used to if you're into this sort of thing. The second thing is Cool actually is a very different kind of search. While Google's fundamental principle is that the results will show up in order of popularity, in other words, the number of other web pages that link to the page in question will drive up someone's Google rank. And that's a very convenient, in many ways brilliant, but somewhat troublesome concept. Because, after all, the right answer isn't always the most popular answer.
It makes it easy to manipulate.
Right, and because companies pay to come up first. depending on the word combination that you're searching.
And that arms race of manipulation has been one of the big sort of understories of Google for some time. Companies do try their best to rig the system. Google tries its best to curb those activities. And as a result, the fundamental principle of Google remains just a principle. There's all sorts of other decisions built into its rather complex algorithm at this point that sort of curb certain accesses. What Cool does is actually analyze the language. It's a very linguistically based search engine.
How are they going to make money, Siva? We just have a little bit of time left, but how do they make money? You talked about Google and the way that they can manipulate the way the searches come up, and they make money. How is Cool going to make money?
As of today, it's really hard to imagine them making money. For one thing,
their debut
seemed to be in a debacle. It's the first day yesterday, it was almost impossible to do a decent search. Their servers were slow. They were crashing. They didn't produce results all the time. But eventually, I suppose, once they build up a user base and they blow through their venture capital money, they're going to start posting ads with the search. That's the only way I can imagine them making money. And that's ultimately what this is about. Remember, for neither of these search
Forget
engines,
the information. It's all about the money.
And the stalking your exes.
And that's Mary Elizabeth Williams,
remember,
our contributor.
We're not the customers here. The advertisers are the customers.
Siva, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Anytime.
Siva Vaidyanathan, he's writing a book, The Googleization of Everything, and that comes out next month, which is actually just a couple of days away. And Mary Elizabeth Williams, our culture critic, is still with us. And now I am going to turn it over to John.
Well, I mean, turn it over. I mean, let's just talk for a second. I mean, do you need a new search engine?
I need to know who's blogging about me.
Do you need a new jetpack?
I need a new jetpack so badly because I live way uptown.
There we go. Yeah, you live way up in Inwood at the tip of Manhattan.
The A takes way too long. The jetpack's going to
So John Schwartz, the New York Times science and technology writer, how long would it take you on the new jetpack you demonstrated the other day to get from 230th Street down to Lower Manhattan?
You could get there a lot faster than you could in a car, maybe not as fast as on a train, once they get it really working. They're still doing a prototype out in New Zealand.
But what a gig. You got to actually demonstrate it.
I really like my job.
Yeah, your job is great. So explain what it felt like. How heavy was it on your shoulders? What kind of fuel does it use? Did you have to, throw your pants away after you used it? What sort of thing?
Well, the first thing is it stands about 5 feet tall, and it stands. It's on three legs, one of which has this pogo strut so that you don't have the knee blowout problem that early jetpack designs caused.
I hate that.
Oh, boy. You come down a little hard, you come down a little fast, and you got a couple of 100 pounds on your shoulders. Oh.
Yeah, that's it for the knees. Now, this thing costs about $100,000, right?
It's going to cost about $100,000, and it weighs a couple of 100 pounds. But because it's on the stands, you don't feel that weight. You strap into it, and then it lifts you.
And so it's got its own little parking platform. And it's going to be demonstrated at the Oshkosh Air Show in Oshkosh, Wisconsin today. But you ran into it in New Zealand. Who actually built this thing?
Oh, actually, it was here in Oshkosh, and I came to Oshkosh early
on
Sunday.
I see. I got it.
Yeah, our travel budget, you know.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's be serious.
Oh,
here.
Yeah. Don't whine to me, pal.
Okay.
So, I want to know, are you way above reality? Are you 4 feet off the ground? Are you 20 feet off the ground? Where
reality,
are you as you're traveling in your jetpack?
Well, when I traveled in the jetpack, I was a couple of feet off the ground because the creator, Glenn Martin, and one of his colleagues was not going to let me fly any higher than that, and they were holding on to me through handrails that they've installed on it.
So it was a real kind of Kitty Hawk affair with the Wright
brothers
and stuff.
It really was.
And, John, it sounds a little crazy.
Well, you know, what isn't crazy? What really fun thing isn't just, you know, on some level?
I don't know,
kooky?
Reading a book?
It's cooler than a scooter.
Yeah, reading books is cool, but it doesn't muss your hair. this was really fun. The inventor himself is still developing this thing. It's got about 600 pounds of thrust. He himself and his coworkers have never taken it above 6 feet, though they film themselves doing very intricate maneuvers, figure eights over the ground. But they're waiting till they really feel they understand it before they take take it to the heights that they could.
We're waiting with bated breath. John Schwartz, it runs on refined hydrogen peroxide, requires lots of training. I'm glad you got a piece of it. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, let me say one thing.
Yep,
it's
sure.
Just plain old gasoline. The old ones did hydrogen peroxide. This thing is really...
No kidding.
Yeah, it's really interestingly developed.
Oh, wow. Well, John Schwartz, New York Times science and technology writer there at the Oshkosh Air Show, speaking to us by phone.
Hey, it's a pleasure.
So would it clash with your dress this morning, Mary Elizabeth Williams?
It would look
Williams,
great with my
culture?
Dress. Great. I'm just afraid that I would still be bumping into people on the sidewalk with the need for speed.
Yeah, well, we could give Amy Winehouse a jetpack. What would that be like?
She's already got her own.
All right, we're going to take it out today. Today on The Takeaway, we're talking about the genealogy of girl pop, a look at the deadly attacks in Iraq over the weekend, power sharing in Zimbabwe. You can weigh in
on any of these issues at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's the thought on the 50th anniversary of NASA.
John, Dartmouth, Massachusetts. What has happened to the United States space program? It's just, I can't believe it.
Well, there you go. There's a thought from one of our listeners. We want to hear from you, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
You can find us online anywhere at FriendFeed or on Facebook. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
Thanks, Mary Elizabeth.
Thanks.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
When punditry goes terribly, terribly wrong.
The feeling most people get when they hear a Barack Obama speech, I felt this thrill going up my leg. I don't have that too often.
Steady.
Call it TMI or just too much Chris Matthews, but body language and television are a powerful mix in electoral politics, doing a political disservice with a smile when a TV anchor's facial expression sinks a network's objectivity. What happens to the ship of state? All aboard, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 9th, and I'm looking closely at John Hockenberry's expression, wondering what he's thinking. Anyhow, we take a look at voters. Do they choose rationally or do they rationalize their choice? The deficit, some Democrats say President Bush gets a gold medal for record debt. NASA turns 50 for good and bad. Texting while walking or driving, believe it or not, it's landing people in the hospital. And Brett Favre, how do we say his name?
Favre.
The famed Green Bay Packer quarterback. Some hope he'll make a comeback. Those stories and all the news.
Go, quarterback.
A new U.S.-backed military operation has begun in the Diyala province northeast of Baghdad. The operation, dubbed Omens of Prosperity, is the latest effort to control a largely rural area considered one of the toughest insurgent strongholds for al-Qaeda in Iraq. An internal audit suggests former Justice Department officials broke the law by weeding out those who were not loyal to the Bush administration during the hiring process. Among questions the report says were asked to potential hires, quote, what is it about George W. Bush that makes you want to serve him?
He's the president. Tough economic news from the White House. First, new federal budget figures show President Bush will leave behind at least a $482 billion deficit for the next president. It's the biggest deficit ever in terms of dollars. And the White House is now offering a gloomier outlook on some of its economic predictions on both growth and unemployment. It now says gross domestic product will grow only 1.6%, while the jobless rate is expected to climb to 5.3% this year and 5.6% next year. Pakistani Prime Minister Yusuf Gilani met with President Bush at the White House yesterday. The visit comes at a tense time. The White House is calling for Pakistan to stop militants from staging cross-border attacks on U.S. forces in Afghanistan. White House spokesperson Dana Perino.
It's tense in that we are working together to try to fight counterterrorism, but I think that we are much more on the same page than some people would like to paint.
Candidate Barack Obama meets with Gilani today.
In politics, Obama will also meet with House Democrats today. John McCain is holding a town hall meeting in Sparks, Nevada, and he will attend fundraisers in Nevada and Colorado.
Oil's gained more than a dollar yesterday. It's just below the $125 a barrel rate. It's low, well below the record, but still moving up. The Dow lost more than 2% yesterday. It starts trading at 11,131. The S&P begins at 1234. We've been talking about jetpacks today.
Yeah, you know what that is?
Yeah, well, there's
you strap it on and you fly in the air.
That's right. There's a jetpack that's being demonstrated today in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. What technology are you waiting for in your lifetime? What would you use a jetpack for? And NASA's having a 50th birthday and wants to go back to the moon. Do you think that's worthwhile?
I don't know. It costs billions of dollars.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, July 29th, and we're looking at some big numbers that have come out of the White House. Of course, an outgoing president leaves his successor many things: Air Force One, the White House, the Rose Garden. But this year, the White House is predicting that President Bush will also leave a record $482 billion deficit. White House officials are blaming congressional Democrats, and the Democrats, well, they're blaming back. The Takeaway is now joined by Todd Zwillick, correspondent for Capital News Connection. Good morning, Todd. Thanks for being with us.
Sure, of course. Good morning.
So the White House announced this projected deficit of $482 billion, but that's not even the right number, is it? Because it doesn't include operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, which would add billions more, wouldn't it?
Billions more. So far, the estimates are we've spent $700 or $750 billion on those operations. The trouble with that is, and the reason why they don't show up on this entire deficit debate, is because that's all been funded off budget. Every time they pass a bill funding Iraq and Afghanistan, they do it in what's called an emergency spending bill or an emergency supplemental. And when you have an emergency in Congress, you know, they can write checks all they want, but it's not on the budget. It's borrowed money. It's not paid for with tax increases or cuts anywhere else. So that's why those costs are yet to be paid.
Todd, why is that? I've never understood it.
Well, this is a way of, you know, it depends on how you look at it. Funding the troops, funding the war, budget fights, deficit fights. This is a whole ball of wax that's difficult to get around in Congress. When you're at war and you have a war that you want to get done, regardless of how you feel about the policy, doing it off budget in an emergency way, frankly, is an easy way, in this case, for the president to get what he wants on spending. You don't have to make the tough decisions. Listen, hey, $750 billion for a war, where are you going to cut that? Are you going to cut it from Medicare? Are you going to raise taxes? This president's not going to raise taxes on everyone to pay for the war, nor is Congress, really. You know, are you going to cut it from programs for the middle class? No, this is a big can kick. You know, it makes it easier on everyone, and of course, then the blame game comes afterward, whose fault that is. But it just kind of makes it easier on everyone to fund the war effort without having to really worry about it until later, the money anyway.
White House officials are blaming congressional Democrats. How is the White House saying the Democrats are at fault here?
Well, the White House is critical of Democrats for spending. The Democrats are critical of the White House for spending, not only on the war, but for spending on other things. You know, there's a lot of Republicans in Congress who accuse their own president, their own Republican president, of being a profligate spender. So there's a lot of people in Congress of both parties who frankly don't really think that the president has a very strong set of legs to stand on when it comes to spending. The president's tax cuts are a big issue here. One of the president's main platforms when he got elected, you remember this, was a big tax cut for wealthier people. Well, that's revenue, and you can philosophically agree with tax cuts, but for people here in Washington, that's a huge chunk of revenue that they don't have to play with anymore. And that's going to affect the next president, too, because especially a president potentially like Obama has big plans for health care, a lot of other things. But health care, just to start, $100 billion a year. On the low end for him to accomplish his health care goals, he's going to have to get rid of those tax cuts.
Finally, the White House threw this number out there yesterday. Why? And ultimately, it really only matters now to the next president, because it's not as if President Bush is going to be able to erase that between now and December.
Right, he's not. This is definitely, without a doubt, a gift for the next president and the next Congress, and for me and you and our kids. Why did they do it? Well, it's a little thing here in Washington called the mid-session review. This is actually done as a matter of schedule. Right around the end of the Congress, the White House Budget Office always puts out the federal deficit and debt numbers. So this was just sort of a matter of schedule. But it does, you're right, it does give sort of a gloomy picture for the next president to deal with. You know, McCain goes around saying he's going to be far more responsible on spending than Obama will, and there's a lot of indications that that's probably true. Now, he'd have to cut a lot of popular social programs to do that. But when Obama meets with the House Democrats today and meets with the budget directors, they're going to have to talk about spending.
A lot of talk about spending. Todd Zwillick, thank you.
My pleasure.
Todd Zwillick comes to us from the Capital News Connection in Washington, D.C. John?
$500 billion in debt, and it's just a matter of scheduling to announce. I don't have a credit line like that. happy birthday, NASA. Here's a number for you. NASA has spent nearly $800 billion in space. Joining us now is Dr. Alex Rowland, who's a professor of history at Duke University. Dr. Rowland, you know, the birthday is definitely worth celebrating. There's a lot of history associated with NASA, but it's also a story of big science maybe gone wrong in our era. Why should NASA perhaps not be so celebratory on its 50th birthday?
Well, the space program has kind of gone off the tracks. The current administrator, Michael Griffin, has said that the space shuttle and the space station were a mistake, and he proposes to lead NASA back to a better program. But actually, what he's proposing to do is the same thing that NASA's been doing ever since the Apollo program, that is for 35 years or more, trying to go back to the moon and go to Mars. And if he continues with that policy, I think the next 35 years in space is going to look very much like the last 35 years.
Well, the Carl Sagan mission in space was all about using the Earth as a platform for creating a launch platform to get to the planets and then maybe out to the, you know, farther reaches of the galaxy. Not something that was going to happen in a few months. But what problems do we have to solve to even begin that mission, and you know, what have we avoided by doing the kind of flag on the moon projects?
Right. What we really have to do to achieve NASA's vision and Carl Sagan's vision, especially if it entails sending people out into space, is develop a launch vehicle that can get us from the surface of the Earth up to low Earth orbit practically, safely, and economically. This is what the shuttle was supposed to do, and the shuttle has been an abject failure in that regard. But instead of getting on with building a launch vehicle that we really need, NASA decided that it was going to simply fly the shuttle, and the costs of the shuttle are what have made the space station impractical. So if NASA wants to realize its vision, it has to invest now in research and development for a better launch vehicle. If you're going to fly to Mars, it costs you as much to fly the first 200 miles up into low Earth orbit as it costs to go all the rest of the millions of miles to Mars and back.
Wow. Talk about fuel for a minute. I mean, we always carry our fuel into space from sources on Earth. To actually do an interplanetary capability, what are we going to need to develop there?
Well, the fuel is the problem because we have to carry it up into space, because we're dependent upon chemical rockets to get up into low Earth orbit. We have to carry all that weight with us. We need a different launch vehicle. Once we're in space, it requires comparatively little fuel to move around and to accelerate to great speeds. So the real problem is getting from here to low Earth orbit.
And there's no way that the shuttle, which I guess is a billion-dollar mission, I mean, if they call it a space bus, that's quite a fare box there on the shuttle. But there's no way to use the space station, even in some different configuration, as a lower Earth orbit launch capability to get to the moon or Mars?
Not this space station.
Really?
That's what the space station was really envisioned for to start with. But they realized that with being dependent on the shuttle, it was too expensive to build and maintain the space station they wanted. So what we have really is a pared-down space station that isn't good for much of anything except for people to sit on it in a kind of flagpole sitting to demonstrate that we can do it. There isn't even much science going on it.
Well, last thing then. China has entered the race. There's private sector entries here. Do they offer any sort of innovations that NASA can't begin to come up with?
Ever since Apollo, NASA has been trying to create the impression that there is some kind of new space race going on as a justification for their own programs, because truth be told, we will no doubt go back to the moon and go to Mars and other places eventually, but there is no race. There's no rush to get there, and NASA needs to stop what it's doing and get on with the serious business of building a launch vehicle that will make it possible.
Sober thoughts for a 50th birthday. Dr. Alex Rowland, thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Alex Rowland is a professor of history at Duke University. We've got some responses on the website.
We do. Derek says to us, this country should have kept going to the moon. We were getting good at the process, and the technology was getting cheaper and better. It's an absolute shame, he says, that politics proved the only reason we went at all was the need to best an enemy.
Can we do anything, Dylan, to help our friend Evan, who's on the website saying, I'm waiting for a bus to take me to New York City and I'm wishing for a jetpack? Can we help Evan out at all? All right, great. We're going to send him one right away. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
All we can say is, Evan, we feel your pain.
The feeling most people get when they hear a Barack Obama speech, I felt this thrill going up my leg. I don't have that too often.
Steady.
The feeling most people get, the world according to MSNBC's Chris Matthews. He was clearly unabashed in sharing his thought, but does his thoughts really matter to voters?
He's usually so circumspect, Chris Matthews, but Mr. Poker Face.
This goes to the very significant point that we're going to get to with our science writer pal. All the coverage we see about Obama, does that influence voters? How about the ads that McCain is running accusing the media of being biased? Does that influence voters? What do you think? Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's what science writer Jonah Lehrer thinks. His work appears on the Frontal Cortex blog. He says the facial expressions of news anchors is just the beginning. It turns out all sorts of factors influence voters. And we're not talking about the issues, right, Jonah?
No, voters aren't exactly rational creatures.
And how are they irrational then, by implication?
Well, there's a famous study that actually looked at how Peter Jennings' facial expressions influenced voters in the 1984 election. A psychologist at Syracuse University, he had voters rate the facial expressions of the big three anchors, so Tom Brokaw, Dan Rather, and Peter Jennings. And he found that Dan Rather and Tom Brokaw were pretty equal when talking about Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale, who were running in the 1984 presidential election, except Peter Jennings, who, when talking about Walter Mondale, was rated an average of 13. And so these facial expressions were rated from 1 to 21, with 21 being a big beaming smile and 1 being an angry frown. When talking about Mondale, it was about 13. When talking about Ronald Reagan, it was a 17. So there was a big statistical difference.
Jonah, you're really going to have to help me here, because I actually worked at ABC News for a long time. And I got to tell you, Peter Jennings' expression is pretty usually not scrutable. You couldn't necessarily tell when he sort of lit up. Convince me that this is actually the case, that there's some subtle facial expression that somehow voters, are they looking for that, or is it just something they read into it?
Well, it's hard to tell, but when people were rating these anchors, they really perceived a difference. Even though Peter Jennings might seem like he's speaking equally about Walter Mondale and Ronald Reagan, when people were asked to actually rate their expressions, and this is a big sample, he asked hundreds of people, they actually thought Peter Jennings was smiling a little bit more when talking about Ronald Reagan. More importantly, Brian Mullen, the psychologist, then went back and looked at how people who watched the different broadcasts actually voted. And he found that, sure enough, people who watched ABC News were much more likely to vote for Ronald Reagan.
That's interesting.
What's even more interesting is that, then you could suggest that, well, it's just people who were, leaning towards Reagan were going to watch ABC News anyways.
Right.
Well, he actually showed that the content of ABC News was the most critical of Reagan. So even though the ideas, the actual content of the broadcast was the most anti-Reagan, Peter Jennings subtle facial expression seemed to overwhelm the actual content of the broadcast.
You know, this raises an issue which I've always thought about in television, but I've never seen any sort of scientific basis for it, and that is that people seem to be very attuned to the implicit messages, the sort of conspiratorial, what's he really thinking kind of information that is conveyed in television body language and sort of eye blinks and camera moves, and less pay attention to the explicit messages of what the actual issues and content are. You're saying this is broadly true in politics as well.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think that's a basic truism about how the brain works. We're very sensitive to subliminal kind of, you know, implicit cues. And
but
while
there's an assumption in there that's problematic for me, which is you're assuming that everyone who's watching is perceiving the exact same thing based on whatever that small physical manner or expression might be.
Certainly, and there are undoubtedly individual differences. Some people probably watched Peter Jennings and didn't perceive that gap. But keep in mind, these are big surveys of lots of people. And so, you know, in the sum total, these things do seem to have a real effect.
Let's also talk about, it's not just who you watch, but where you vote influences how you vote.
Yeah, there's a brand new study out in Proceedings by researchers at Stanford, and they found that people who vote in schools, and keep in mind where you vote is arbitrarily assigned, are much more likely to vote, significantly more likely, so on average 2-4% more likely, which is more than enough to sway a close election, to vote for a sales tax increase when voting in a school. And you're less likely to vote for a stem cell initiative when voting in a church.
I love that.
So where you vote, and these things are completely arbitrarily assigned, actually has real consequences. You know, that in retrospect makes perfect sense. When you're voting in a school, you're more likely to think about all the things schools do for your community. And so sure, it's probably a good idea to vote for a sales tax increase so they can build more schools. And when you're voting in a church, you're primed is the technical word here.
What about a barn?
You're more likely to vote for farm subsidies. But you make another point here, Jonah, which is that not only are voters not necessarily rational, but they aren't even consistent. You're saying that there are studies showing that rephrasing polling questions often results in different answers from the same people?
Yeah. You know the research, for example, gave voters and did put them in different spots and showed that the same people who would support a sales tax in a school wouldn't support a sales tax if they had to vote in government office. So you can really switch around people's preferences simply by putting them in different polling locations, by having them watch different news broadcasts, et cetera, et cetera. We're very vulnerable. We're very inconsistent.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about, Jonah Lehrer. We're going to ask you to stick around because right now we need to get some headlines. Jonah Lehrer is going to stay with us, science writer whose work appears on the Frontal Cortex blog. Now, Femi with the latest headlines. Femi.
Thank you. It's 28 minutes past the hour. The U.S. military has launched a new operation to fight insurgents in the volatile Diyala province northeast of Baghdad. In Pakistan, Islamic militants have abducted 30 police and paramilitary who are patrolling in the northwest of the country in an area increasingly under Islamist control. A new Justice Department report confirms that former Justice Department aides used improper hiring practices to favor people loyal to President Bush. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that former Pentagon official Richard Perle, who was a key voice in the push for going into Iraq, is exploring going into the oil business in Iraq and Kazakhstan. And finally, as the countdown to the Olympic Games continues, human rights group Amnesty International has chosen today to unveil criticism of China's human rights record. This is Amnesty International spokesperson Mark Allison.
We continue to call on world leaders planning to attend the Games to speak out now to prevent the authorities from using their attendance as a tacit endorsement of violations perpetrated in preparation for the Olympics.
China was very quick to respond. Xiong Lei, China's Society for Human Rights Studies member, was very quick to respond.
I don't want to follow the line of Amnesty International. I don't think it has the right to teach us what to do and what not to do.
China also complained that Amnesty International was seeing China through tinted spectacles.
I love that Richard Perle story you just did. He was not only one who pushed for Iraq, but he also said that the Iraq war was not about oil. That was his argument.
And your point would be what, John?
Well, now he's
going
into
the
oil
business.
Yeah.
That's a coincidence.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks for that. Hell of a job, buddy. Hope you find oil. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Good morning. It's Tuesday. It's July 29th, and here we are. It's The Takeaway, and we're asking you, NASA celebrates its 50th birthday. Should they go back to the moon? Should they do something else? What's your thought? 877-8-MY-TAKE, and here's what someone had to say.
Yes, name's Peter Johnson, calling from Huntington, Long Island. I definitely believe we should be back on the moon, and not limited to only the moon.
All right, thank you, Peter. I'm just going to send a text message off to my producer there. I did that. Also with us is Jonah Lehrer, the science writer, who is the author of the book Proust Was a Neuroscientist. And if I don't watch out, I might just actually hit my head on the microphone here. Brian Fuhr, you actually injured yourself while texting someone last summer. Can you tell me about it?
Yes, I did. I was walking my dog last summer on a street in New York when I decided to send a text message. And as I looked down, a bicycle messenger ran me over, and I broke several toes.
As you looked down and you broke several toes, and I'm really sorry about that, but would it be an insult? Would it be wrong to say, you moron, why did you walk and text at the same time?
Well, you know, some people might see it that way. Others might see it as trying to do two things at once. Others might see it as trying to be in two places at the same time.
Well, fortunately, we have Jonah Lehrer with
places?
Us, who knows
two
how
places
the,
at the same time.
Who
okay.
knows how the brain deals with doing two things at once. But we also have Dr. Linda Lawrence with us, who's the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. You know, Dr. Lawrence, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
But it seems to me when we have to have a doctor on the air to remind people to watch what they're doing, look where they're going, it may be close to the end of the world. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I don't know if I quite say it's the end of the world, but I would say that there's important lessons to be learned from what your other viewers shared. You know, we're seeing a rise of these type of injuries in our emergency departments across the country, and it probably links to the ease of having texting services. But you really can't be two places at the same time, and you do need to watch where you're going. And so we're discouraging texting while moving.
Let me ask Brian for a second. What do you think the solution is here? Is there a form of kind of awareness or decorum or sharing the sidewalk that maybe is a fix here? Because obviously, you know, putting a blindfold on in a city, and you live in Manhattan, is probably not a great idea.
No, you're right. I think there is an interesting question about what the solution might be. I don't think the solution is going backwards, however. I think the solution is looking for other ways to stay in touch with people who aren't with you. And when you're texting someone, you're reaching out to someone to have them find you, to share a moment with them, to respond to a message. You're trying to make a connection. And we have to wait for a better technology that will allow people to make better connections. And perhaps then there'll be fewer accidents.
Brian, when you were run over by the bicycle messenger and were lying there on the sidewalk with your broken toes, did you cry for help or did you text someone?
Very good question. I crawled back to my stoop and then got myself upstairs, so I did not cry out for help. No.
You crawled. Dr. Lawrence, let me ask you this. You've likened texting and while walking, while talking, while driving, as almost someone who is blindly moving forward. Why can't we do two things at once? We multitask all the time. Why not text and walk?
Well, I think you need to be aware of the dangers of it. Unfortunately, we've seen accidents in our emergency departments in this country that have been tragic, where people have walked out in front of moving cars because they're not paying attention. And, you know, when you think about it, all you need to do is stop if you want to answer that text message or send a new one, and stop whatever you're doing, get out of the way and focus on that, and then start walking again. I mean, I think the solution is fairly simple, how to be safer.
Do your kids listen to your advice, Dr. Lawrence?
That's a good question.
You have two, right?
I do. I have two children, and we just recently got them both cell phones with, of course, the texting service, because that's what young kids want nowadays. And they thought it was kind of crazy when I told them these stories, but hopefully they are listening to me.
Hopefully. Jonah, why does the brain seem to yearn to do so many things at once rather than doing, as Dr. Lawrence suggests, stopping one thing and moving on to the next thing?
I think multitasking is just part of the modern condition, but I think what the brain can teach us about multitasking is that we're very, very bad at it. You know, trying to walk and text and you know, web surf on your phone all at the same time is like trying to run Microsoft Vista on a 5-year-old computer. It just kind of short circuits the brain. We just can't handle it. We can't pay attention to the bike in the slow lane when we're texting. So I think the lesson here is that our brain is a bounded, limited piece of machinery, and we should be aware of its limits.
Joan Allaire, of course, is the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. He's a science writer who's been joining us this hour. Brian Fuhr, we're going to say goodbye to you, but before we go, do you do anything differently since your accident?
I don't text and drive. I didn't do that before, though, either. So, no, I don't do that much differently. I'm a little more careful when I cross the street. I look both ways. I do take the doctor's advice and put the phone down as I am looking to cross the street, but I'm still texting.
All right, Brian, thank you very much for joining us. And Dr. Linda Lawrence, should there be clear, see-through BlackBerries? Is that really the solution here?
That's not going to work because you're still going to be focused on reading the message that comes. I think what's happened is we were so used to being able to pick up a phone and talk, and we think picking up our phone and texting is the same thing. But it's not, because when you're talking to somebody on the phone, you are still looking around, and you're probably listening with your other ear.
And we're evolved to talk and walk at the same time, maybe not text and walk at the same time.
Exactly.
That's a few hundred million years away. Dr. Linda Lawrence, president of the American College of Emergency Physicians, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. We need a reverse alarm to survive this 21st century.
Or a couple hundred more million years, as you said.
It's got to be brain implants. That's the next technology. What do you think? We were talking about jetpacks earlier. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Now we go to Femi Oke, who's got the headlines for us.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 20 minutes to the hour. The White House is offering a gloomy economic forecast, saying the gross domestic product will grow only 1.6% this year, while the jobless rate is expected to climb 5.3%. A man who the police say entered a Unitarian Universalist church in Knoxville, Tennessee on Sunday and shot 8 people, killing 2, was motivated by a hatred for liberals and gay people. That's according to the Knoxville Police Department. The number of homes destroyed by the so-called Telegraph Fire that's raging near California's Yosemite National Park is now up to 25, but as many as 4,000 others are threatened by the flames. Australia has unveiled new immigration laws, scrapping its policy of automatically locking up asylum seekers on arrival. Now, this new policy doesn't mean that asylum seekers won't be locked up at all, but it does actually cover all children who used to be put in asylum as well. And John McCain is waiting for the results of biopsy about his dermatologist after his dermatologist removed a spot from his cheek. The candidate says it does not seem serious.
There's been a lot of coverage of the McCain story this morning on other news outlets.
Because it just leads you to think about the VP nomination, how important that might be, not wanting to be too grim about it.
Well, also McCain's history of skin cancer. I mean, it's actually real.
Yeah, literally a survivor.
Yeah. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
Is that new music, John?
Sounds new.
I think so. I'm Adora Udoji. Thanks, Dylan, for that. We enjoyed it. Joe Edley, you there?
I'm here.
Did you hit a bingo this week?
Quite a few.
Quite a few. Joe Edley is the only person ever to win the Scrabble National Championship 3 times. You are in Orlando, Florida right now, and it's a big week for Scrabble players like yourself. Hundreds are fighting it out for the title, and it's really a special year, isn't it? Scrabble turns 60. Why do you think it's lasted so long?
Well, it's innately fun. People get the aha experience, taking a jumble of letters and finding a word in them.
And that bingo would be a big aha. Tell us what that means in Scrabble.
Well, when you play bingo, that means you've used all 7 of your tiles in one play, and you get an extra 50 points, which is huge.
And does a bell go off somewhere in the background?
No, maybe in each player's head.
Now you've been
feels great.
Now you've been a fan for how long, and how much of a fan? I mean, tell me, is XI a word?
XI, sure, it's a Greek letter. I've been a fan for 30 years, basically. 1978, I took it up seriously. And, in fact, I took a job as a desk clerk to study 4 or 5 hours a day for 2 years. And then I played in the 1980 Nationals, and I was fortunate enough to win it.
Isn't that a bit much? You actually organized your life around Scrabble, a game?
That's a long story, but the short of it is that it took me 10 years in my 20s to figure out that, you know, games can be not only fun, but they can improve people's lives in many ways.
And, how has it improved yours?
Well, yeah, outside of the obvious that I've been working at it for 20 years, there's something innately positive about having the experience of competing, finding words from the jumble of letters, socializing with people who love the same thing, and people love it. People love it. So I know I'm doing a good thing when I'm teaching the game, when I'm playing in a tournament, when I'm promoting the game. Mm-hmm. It's just innately fun.
Give me some advice. We're big Scrabble players in my house, and my mother has this way of always basically kicking our behinds. What? Give me something I can battle, go to battle with her.
Well,
with.
There are 101 two-letter words. You need to learn them. We have those words at the National Scrabble Association on a list. And if you learn them and then learn how to play parallel, make parallel plays, if you have idea on the board, you can play foxy right below it, parallel, making I-F-D-O-E-X and A-Y, and you get a huge number of points that way. You learn how to play parallel, you'll score a lot more than your family members.
Finally and very quickly, is this an extra special 60th anniversary of Scrabble since you're actually 60 yourself this year?
Yes, I am. I was hoping that maybe I could win it again this year, but I don't think I'm going to get that far. But, yeah, it's special for me.
Joe Edley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Joe Edley coming to us from Orlando, Florida, where the National Scrabble Championship is taking place. I admire anyone who can win a championship in Scrabble. It's tough. You ever play, John?
Oh, yeah. I hate Scrabble. But he had a really foxy idea there. I just lose all the time. I get behind, and then I'm done.
It's your toast.
I'm looking for Z's always.
Good morning on this Tuesday, July 29th. We have lots of folks on the line. Jonah Lehrer, the science writer, is still with us. And we also have Femi Oke, who's here with the very latest headlines. Femi?
Does that mean I have to speak fast so Jonah doesn't get bored listening to me? Jonah, I'll make it interesting for you. Coming up for you at 12 minutes to the hour, Merrill Lynch is liquidating more than $30 billion in mortgage assets at a steep loss and says it will raise $8.5 billion in new stock. It's all part of a plan to deal with the credit crisis. Barack Obama met with his chief economic advisers yesterday and says if elected, he'd move rapidly and vigorously to respond to the sagging economy. He also says that another round of stimulus measures is necessary. John McCain has changed his position on offshore drilling. Up to a month ago, he opposed it. Now he says offshore drilling has to be incorporated into any energy plan to lower gas prices. And a University of Pittsburgh study has found that women who want to lose weight and keep it off need to be exercising for almost an hour, 5 days a week. Got to go jogging now. That's your news.
Run along then. Got some exercising.
Tired just
you,
reading
Femi.
It. You're welcome.
5 days a week. Gosh.
So, Johnny, here's a quick question. If you're really good at something, but you have to move on, how hard is it for your brain to do that?
To learn a new skill?
To learn, to just move on, to just move your identity away from the thing you're the best at.
It's probably very tough. I mean, you know, to become an expert at anything, whether it's, you know, be an expert chess player, be a great athlete, it takes about 10,000 hours of what scientists call deliberate practice. So I imagine it's very tough to know. You've given your entire life to learn, you know, to developing this one skill. Then all of a sudden, because your contract's up, you've got to move on. That's got to be tough.
Well, it's the view of science writer Jonah Lehrer, who's with us, author of Proust, was a neuroscientist. Imagine how hard it is for Brett Favre. Jerry Watson is joining us from the Stadium View Bar, and Rick Stratton is joining us from Packers blog, packerblog.com. They're both in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where the issue of Brett Favre's retirement is not academic. It's very, very real. Jerry, what do you think? Should Brett come back, or should he stay out?
I think he should come back until he's replaced with somebody that's better, proven better.
Rick Stratton, why is this such a controversy in Green Bay? For years, Brett Favre's retirement was something they feared. Now fans maybe fear his return because of all the mess-ups it's going to produce in the personnel in the Green Bay Packers.
Well, I think everyone's just pretty sick of of Favre's back and forth seesaw on whether he wants to play or not. And we're all kind of ready to move on.
But, you know, Favre and Joan Allaire mentioned it a moment ago. I mean, it must be really, really difficult. I mean, here he's been to two Super Bowls. He's won one. He had extraordinary numbers last year. I mean, it must be pretty difficult for Favre to move on and just become a third string on some team somewhere else outside of Green Bay. Rick?
I'm sorry about that. Yeah, you know, he's... I think he's had a lot of trouble trying to retire. I think that once he retired, he realized that you can't play golf all that much, and he doesn't have much else to do. So he decided the only thing he does well is play football. So he wants to come back.
Rick, that's so harsh. Can a person change their mind?
Well, it's one thing to change your mind, but we've been going through this for the last, I believe, three off seasons. And this offseason, after he retired, within weeks he asked back. The Packers said, sure, come on back. And he said, nah, never mind, I'm not interested. And then he goes on Letterman and says he kind of wants to come back. So I think that the on-again, off-again has really gotten to the Packers executives and to the GM, Ted Thompson.
Jerry Watson, you're a fan, and it sounds to me like you want Brett Favre to return. But whose life does this really mess up on the team right now?
Ted Thompson's, because I think Ted has a problem with the truth. And then I guess what we should really do is, it's like any other job or any other competition, let the best man prevail. And that's what they aren't doing. They made up their mind that Aaron Rodgers is the number one quarterback in Green Bay, and he is right now because Brett's down in Hattiesburg. But I think once Brett shows back up in Green Bay, I think they'll know who's number one.
Well,
but when you aren't playing for it, there's no competition.
Rick, let me take a cynical view here. The NFL has certainly always been known for its ability to fill the seats and to create entertainment value above and beyond simply the game. I mean, perhaps this adds a quality of kind of, World Wrestling Federation, the return of Brett Favre, where personalities drive rather than the game. The NFL did pretty well with the T.O.'s drama going to the Dallas Cowboys. Maybe the NFL actually loves this.
Well, I think I don't know if the NFL loves this, but we're talking about, we've got lots of action in baseball going this summer, and we're spending a lot of time talking about Favre. He's even got his own ticker on ESPN, if you watch, every night. But meanwhile, here in Wisconsin, I think the media is going nuts for this. I think it's wrecked quite a few vacations for these guys. And the sad thing is we started training camp on Sunday, and we're stuck talking about this rather than talking about the upcoming season.
But is that all bad? I mean, Dolly Parton, I think, makes a point, which is, all publicity is good publicity. Isn't this ultimately perhaps good for the game, engaging people in a discussion as to whether or not there should be a final line for players?
Well, I don't think that the NFL needs too much controversy to get itself in the headlines. I think this is kind of a sad thing that we've all been through. And, nothing is sadder about this than for our fans here in Wisconsin, who, Favre is our hero. And now in the polls that we've seen on our site and on other sites, it's almost 60-40 against Favre and pro-Packers, even though most of us really don't like the GM, Ted Thompson.
Leave them wanting more. Jerry Watson, owner of the Stadium View Sports Bar, where the fans, I would say, are probably pro-Favre. Jerry, thanks for being with us.
Sure, thank you much.
And Rick Stratton, the head of the Packers blog, packerblog.com. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
What position does Dolly Parton play? I forget.
She's
a center?
She's a commentarian on American pop culture.
So Joan Allaire, we've gone through quite a sort of a journey here, beginning with subliminal messages influencing politics to possibly brain implants to help us text and not walk into a wall, and ending with how do you change
your
life?
That was your idea.
Well,
brain implants. Jonah, don't let him get away with that. He makes it sound as if that was a legitimate discussion.
We are, and Scrabble even, we're just talking about the brain, right, Jonah?
Yeah, I mean, in the end, everything comes back to these 3 pounds of wrinkled flesh you have inside your head.
And 3 pounds of wrinkled flesh. There's a nice visual for you.
Is that the title of your next book?
3 pounds of wrinkled flesh. I will take that to my publisher.
Take that to your publisher.
It's a good idea.
Jonah, what's the takeaway today about multitasking in the brain, about letting go of things? What's your tagline here?
What's my tagline?
Ouch, man,
I think we should be aware of the foibles of our brain, whether it's multitasking or the fact that our brain really wants, you know, we get so attached to something like the Green Bay Packers when it's just a team filled with very well-paid and slightly overweight players.
And, you know, it's all about body language. So, I mean, that's what makes it hard to watch the NFL.
Yeah,
because you can't see those guys, what they actually, you know, are doing to the other players under all the armor that they wear.
Although I was talking to one high school player who talked about how watching someone's eyes is very important. You can still see their eyes. And so you fixate on their pupils.
Is that a haunting quality of the game that you miss out if you're just watching as a spectator?
Probably.
Well, the NFL's got to be developing eye cams.
I'm sure that's in the works.
But it is interesting because it is all about game face and psyching people up. And, of course, you can't broadcast most of the language on the field, but there's all kinds of communication going on between the players across that line.
Yeah, well, just I think we get such a skewed view of the game. We look at the game from so up high. And down in the field, it's, you know, on TV, it looks like some kind of really well-choreographed ballet, but down in the field, I imagine it's this violent brawl. So I think we really don't get a sense of just how violent the game is and how it really does come down to really big men hitting each other very hard while staring each other in the eye.
Well choreographed on a good Sunday. Jonah Lehrer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jonah Lehrer is a science writer and the author of Proust Was a Neuroscientist. It's a great book. It's really all about how the brain is involved with everything. From cooking to
I would kind of guess that
poetry to
since
yeah, it's a great book.
Directs our thought and actions.
Today on The Takeaway, we got a full plate. The genealogy of girl pop, a look at the deadly attacks in Iraq over the weekend, and the offensive that's underway there. Also, power sharing in Zimbabwe.
And we want you to weigh in on these or any other issue at 8778 My Take. What's your take?
And what's the takeaway for today?
Reading books is cool, but it doesn't muss your hair.
That was John Schwartz from the New York Times talking about how books can't compare to the new jetpack at the Oshkosh Air Show. Otherwise, you won't get that cool, windswept look. You want a jetpack? You can reach us.
At thetakeaway.org. You threw me off there, John. You can find us online at www.thetakeaway.org.
I'm still recovering from Dolly Parton as a football player. I'm John Hockenberry.
You never know what you're going to hear when you listen to The Takeaway.
You can reach us on FriendFeed or Facebook. Thanks for joining us.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.